Well, pirates are all over the high seas. We know this now more than ever. We know it, of course, because the story we began to live more prominently here in this country came when that U.S. ship had been captured, or at least a ship with a U.S. crew on it. And then the U.S. Navy came to the rescue. And we know what happened there off the coast of Somalia, but it may be easy to think it's just Somalia, and it's not, and it's everywhere. And it may, as Captain Kelly Sweeney, who's a frequent guest in the show, has indicated in the past, it may be a case where it goes so underreported that we don't even begin to have the full numbers to account for the amount of piracy that's happening on the high seas, mostly because of insurance and business reputations. We'll get into that when we talk with Daniel Sekulich coming up. It's his new book, Terror on the High Seas, True Tales of Modern Day Pirates. This is the definitive work on that subject, which we'll get to coming up. But I also got to ask him about his other book, his book about looking for the soul of a ship. We'll start off with that first, and then we'll get into pirates coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Daniel Sekulich is an award-winning documentary filmmaker for both, as he says here, in film and also for TV, like for channels like the History Channel in Canada, as well as being an author and a reporter of fascinating stories from around the world, doing the research, not just sitting somewhere in a nice, comfortable chair in some, you know, home office. He's actually out there researching it where it matters. True Tales of Modern Day Pirates, Terror on the Seas. Daniel Sekulich, how are you this evening?
I'm very well, Ian. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Am I close on the name pronunciation?
You're spot on.
Okay, good. So you'd be surprised how many guests I get wrong, and they don't even tell me till like halfway through the show, and I hate that. So in researching your book, you said you started to grow interested in piracy. This was before it was really getting traction in terms of the popular media. And so you were looking into this story before the story was cool. We'll talk more about that, but you were doing it while you were working on this book called Ocean Titans, Journeys in Search of the Soul of a Ship. I am so hooked. Why didn't we have this book when this one came out? Why didn't you send this one to us?
My agent, my publicist may have. You know, if piracy is underreported and rarely seen until it makes really, really big headlines, the lives of people who work professionally as seafarers today is even more underreported.
Sure, sure. I totally get that. And yet we're fascinated by this on the show. We have a regular guest who's a sea captain, and he comes on and reports to us when he's back in port, and I love that. But I mean, that's a really, if your publicist knew about Coast to Coast and didn't send us that book, you should fire them. Let's just do a little bit on that now, because when you say the soul of a ship, maybe we're coming at this from two different angles, but what little I read about the book, I think I'm getting where you're coming from, is you really, there is a kind of character to a ship, especially these big ships, that seems to have a kind of a palpable life force, or am I overstating that?
No, I don't think you are. I think that what I discovered when I was working on the last book was that my approach as a landlubber, as an outsider, which may have been somewhat romantic, didn't quite jibe with what a lot of professional seafarers feel. But instead, it was modified. And what I learned from them and from traveling around and from visiting everybody from shipwrights in yards in Korea to ship breakers in places in Alang, like Alang, India, was that they did feel a connection with the vessels. But the connection was not, it wasn't inanimate. It went along with the experience of other human beings being there. There is an energy which comes only from the social environment of other human beings occupying that space in the middle of the ocean.
Right, right. But a kind of gestalt almost, right? Greater than the sum of its parts somehow.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you go aboard a museum ship, even if you something like the Queen Mary, for instance, down in Long Beach,
right.
I mean, it's interesting, but it's somewhat lifeless. because its days are gone. It's a shadow of its former self, and that's because the people who made it vibrant, who made it alive, aren't there anymore. And those people, generally speaking, who enliven it, are the crew who have a connection with it.
Now, I've heard tell from people that if you have a ship, you have a working ship, it has a character of its own, so much so that if you took off one crew and put another crew on it and told the new crew nothing of what the old crew thought about the ship, about her idiosyncrasies, or about the way that the ship seems to respond in a storm, or a sense of confidence from the ship, or just this kind of the spirit of the ship. Again, not trying to get too literal about that, but I've been told that that you will invariably find that new crew will have the same opinion of the ship that the old crew did. And this is true particularly in naval vessels for the U.S. Navy, where they can sometimes be passed down to two to three different generations of sailors, and the some will never have any idea what the other generations have done, but they'll come to the same conclusion about the ship.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a story I remember, Ian, that was told to me by, he was actually a priest in Europe, and he worked with mariners when they came into port. And he was called down one time when a crew that was from the Far East was coming aboard on a rotation to a new merchant ship. And they were completely spooked about the ship. Something wasn't right, they didn't feel right, and they really felt nervous. So he got a call from the shipping agent. I went to meet with the captain, who had been aboard previously, and to find out what was going on. And the captain said that previous crew, there had been a death. One of the crew members had passed away while they'd been at sea, and they had taken him off and presumably sent him home to be buried.
Right.
Well, it turned out that the new crew could feel something that was just not right about the ship. And so although they weren't Christian, they asked that this priest perform a ceremony, just to make them feel better, to make them feel that the spirit of their lost crewmate, could somehow be exercised. And after that, things apparently went okay.
Okay, so you went in search of the soul of a ship in your last book, and we'll get to the new one here, I promise. But in the last book, you went trying to find it. What did you find when you were searching for the soul of a ship?
Well, I really found that it's amazing how many people who don't necessarily have a connection with one another actually have some sort of bond that is tied together by a ship. And by that I mean, I talked with shipwrights in South Korea who built vessels. And later on I talked to people who were sailing aboard ships that had come out of those same yards but had never met the shipwrights. And they were saying really like similar comments about the vessel and about its role and how they felt about it. Somehow this thing carried on all the way through. There was a case one time where I was talking with an architect, naval architect, who was describing seeing one of the first ships that he'd ever designed as it was on its last days and how it brought tears to him. And he said it was like watching my daughter, you know, go away for some reason. It was a really emotional bond. And that was the same thing that a master shipwright in Korea had told me when he said, when every time he watches a ship leave the yard and head off to sea to begin its life, he felt like he was losing a member of his family.
I remember talking to a guy from World War II who was in the Navy that had been on a ship that had been hit and went down. It wasn't as tragic as some of these famous naval sinkings of the World War II could have been. There weren't hundreds of people lost. There were a few hands. There were other ships nearby in the convoy. They got picked up, but they got hit. And he said that it was, he'll never forget, they were all convinced that the ship was trying as hard as it could to stay afloat, that they said they could feel it. And that he was wearing, the reason it started the conversation, he was wearing the cap, right, that a lot of the Navy guys wear, that had the silhouette of the ship, and then it had the name of the ship. I wish I could remember which one of the World War II ships it was, but it wasn't a well-known ship. But he said that they all still say this to the day when they get together in their, you know, every 5 years or so when they get together to find out who's living, he said, you know, of their reunion group from that ship. And he said, we talked about it that day, and we've talked about it ever since. We have dreams about the fact that the ship was trying to stay afloat to give time to get as many of us off the ship as possible. And he said it was almost like, he said he was kind of tearful about it. I mean, it made a big impact on me. It's one of the reasons why I so resonated with this title from your last book, is that he said it was as though the ship were groaning and grunting like anybody would who is trying not to drown. He said you could hear noises that they had never heard from that ship before. And then almost everybody was off, the ship finally, if you will, gave up the ghost and sank. But it was like he said, it was just he'll never forget it. He was so connected to that ship.
Well, and you know, this is the really fascinating thing about seafarers' lives, and this is something that the vast majority of us, we don't understand anymore. You know, even though most of the population of the planet lives on or near water, We no longer really see beyond the horizon line. So we don't know just how strong that bond is between a mariner and their ship when we're in the middle of the ocean. And the pain that ship, you know, feels,
right,
is palpable. And I can remember crossing the Atlantic in late October and encountering a series of severe gales on a ship.
I bet you did, right.
And, you know, it was twisting, it was turning, it was fighting through that storm. And I was up doing the evening watch with the third mate, and you know, he was just sitting there just talking to that ship. Or even a year ago, I was aboard a Laker in the Great Lakes. It was going from Green Bay, Wisconsin up to Duluth through severe ice.
Sure.
And at one point, I remember just stepping back and watching the captain on that ship as he was coaxing her through the ice, and he was talking to her, and there was nobody around. I mean, well, I was around, but he didn't know it. And,
right.
and just that connection, I mean, because it was encountering such physical pain that he could feel it.
Right. That's so interesting to me. It almost makes me verklempt just thinking about it. And I live not too far from Duluth, and I know just the kind of thing you're talking about where, you know, especially, well, you've done a couple of things on the Great Lakes in your research over the years. You have, you know, some fairly unique navigational challenges in the Great Lakes, especially as you get toward the end of the season, end of the shipping season. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I think something like the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald always seems to it still has traction with us. It's so rare almost for a ship to just kind of disappear like that. And there's something about the idea of a ship going down and taking its crew with it and never hearing from it again. And it just it's larger than few other disasters, I think, have the kind of hit us in the same way that naval disasters do. I'll just sum it that way. When a ship just goes, it just disappears. Even when those guys were lost out at sea who were football players off the coast of Florida, there's just something about the fact that it's there as opposed to being in a, you know, if they're just missing in the woods, it's not the same as when you're missing at sea. There's something just so vast and huge and scary about the sea. And it makes you depend on that little boat or that ship, whatever you have, to get you through so much more. I can see why they make connections to it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the sea, you know, can literally swallow you up in a moment.
Right.
And this is also one of the things that I found about mariners is that because when they set out on a merchant vessel, that vessel is not just their workplace, it's also their home. And when they're there and when they're at sea, they have to rely on the professional abilities of their fellow seafarers. I mean, it's a very strong community with a very strong bond. Indeed, the only other community that I know of that is sort of similar in this way is those in the military.
Right.
Because it does become a life and death situation.
Right, right. Well, thank you for indulging me on that. It may come up again in conversation. Let me ask you, are there any such thing as lake pirates anywhere?
There were, yeah, absolutely.
I know there were, but are there any now?
I suspect the only ones are with those who try to get bundles of empty beer bottles or something
right.
on long weekends
right.
from pleasure boats.
Or maybe the people that are running the shipping companies themselves. But
there's a point there, possibly.
But so no more pirates on the Great Lakes. But there was at one time. There were pirates we would have seen here in the U.S. or Canadian coastal waterways, weren't there?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Of course, everybody knows Blackbeard, and Blackbeard ranged up and down the eastern seaboard of the United States. One of the biggest targets, especially across the eastern seaboard of the U.S. and Caribbean, up even into the Canadian east coast, was fishermen. And pirates often went after them, just as they do today still, because they were an easy prey. You could come aboard, steal, whatever trinkets they had. And, it wasn't going to get you as rich as a galleon loaded with Spanish bullion, but it could add up. And there were cases where they would, in one pirate raid, attack 200 or 300 fishing boats in some waters, especially places like the Grand Banks or the George's Banks.
Well, so they would get some good fish that night, but I mean, did these ships have that much in the way of valuables that made that possible? And why wouldn't they have been more equipped if piracy were already a problem back then? Why wouldn't any of these fishing ships be better prepared to fight off pirates?
It's the same reason they aren't today is because pirates were just better armed and more willing to use force. Piracy, it's this age-old problem, and it really fundamentally hasn't changed. It's an economic crime committed by people who are going to come aboard with weapons, whether they're cutlasses or nowadays AK-47s, and they're intent on what they're going to do. And working crews, whether it's a fishing boat or a merchant ship, they've always been primarily unarmed. I mean, they've got better things to do in running a ship. So this situation hasn't changed. Now we're just seeing that the use of the types of force that they have
right.
are a little more sophisticated.
And we'll get into more of the modern piracy stories coming up. And you've done some very interesting work in that way and really gotten firsthand with what the true story of the terror of the high seas is all about. We'll get to that in a bit. But so in a lot of ways, though, if we just to talk about it, they are, these are thugs. These are like the seagoing version of armed robbers in a park who might jump out behind a tree, either hit you over the head and take all your stuff or just stick you up with a gun, take all your stuff, maybe slap you around a little bit just to make you think twice about chasing after them and going. I mean, it's really no more complicated than that, except they're on boats.
Some of them are. Some of them,
okay.
Absolutely. Some of them are definitely hit and run guys. I mean, you'll get that in many ports where they'll climb aboard and sound silly. They'll steal ropes and paint cans, for instance. Doesn't sound like much. The problem is, what happens is as they get more success at smaller things, they become greedier and they start going after more and more. Maybe they'll rough up a crewman and take his cell phone and his wallet. Well, then they decide to actually rough up several of them. Then they decide to maybe capture the crew and hold them hostage. It becomes a situation where petty theft can then lead to more organized criminal elements, which then become highly organized cartels. And unchecked, that's what happens in the growth. And then, for instance, a place like Somalia is the perfect litmus test to watch what's proceeded to the point where they are as multi-million, multinational enterprises nowadays, like the mafia.
Okay. We'll get into that. Where are there no problems with piracy?
Antarctica.
Okay. That's just where we'll leave it then. We'll get back to the true tales of modern pirates. You watch, your next book's going to be Ice Pirates of Antarctica by Daniel Sekulich. Terror on the High Seas is what the new book is called. And we'll talk about the footwork he's done on this story, what he's seen with his own eyes and the people that he's talked to. And then we'll also talk about what can be done then. Maybe the past can teach us a few lessons about how we should handle piracy in the future. And I'll ask Daniel Sekulich about that. Also, it's interesting. We could all name probably 10 well-known pirates, some of whom were never that successful in life, But they were, you know, they garnered a big reputation, even if they didn't have big spoils to speak for it. How come there aren't any well-known pirates today? Or are there? We just haven't heard about them yet here. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, he's met the victims. He's seen the damage up close. He's even talked to some of the pirates himself. We'll talk with Daniel Sekulich. The book is all about terror on the seas, and we'll get into what... just how terrible some of these stories really are. You know, we know about the ones we've heard about, but some of the other stories, well, gosh, they're just as bad or worse. We'll get to that. And we'll ask about the famous pirates of today and what can the past teach us about how to solve this problem in the future. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. True Tales of Modern Pirates, Terror on the Seas, Daniel Sekulich's new book is out. Don't you wish that you had this book out just before that that U.S. crew had been attacked off the coast of Somalia?
Absolutely. In fact, it was originally supposed to be released June 19th. And as a result of what happened with the Maersk Alabama, Martin's Press managed to get it out a couple of weeks ago. That was the fastest they could ship it out in time.
Right, because it's really the perfect book. I mean, if that book had been out just, 8 weeks earlier or 6 weeks earlier, that would have been like right there in the middle of this story, which is weird because although we've been talking about it on Coast to Coast for a long time, piracy and all, it really hadn't been getting the kind of coverage that it got. It took a U.S. crew to get captured and then to be rescued for it to really hit, I think, the mindscape of much of the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah. You know, I got to tell you, Ian, that about 4 years ago when my agent was trying to pitch this project, it was turned down by dozens of publishers. Because at the time, you know, they had some assistant do a Google search, and it looked like piracy was on the wane.
Yeah.
But as I'd found out when working on my last book, Ocean Titans, these mariners I was sailing with kept telling me these stories, and this is what I found fascinating, just to begin with. But the other thing they kept saying to me is that the real story is much bigger than what was being reported. And I was somewhat taken aback by that. And, of course, when I tried to say to publishers, look, there's a bigger story here, they couldn't see it. St. Martin's Press, luckily, did see it and went with it,
right.
And it's been proven out because, you know, the officials that I met with would say to me, not even candidly, but openly, that the real figures of pirate attacks and maritime robberies and maritime crimes around the world are 2 to 3 times higher than what is being reported. And that's, you know, that's startling.
That $25 billion figure, is that then your estimate based on what actually is happening, or that's the official reported figure?
Well, when it comes to criminal activities, it's hard to get a definitive figure that you can firmly put down. I mean, we can't
right.
keep track of the deficit anymore. The figures for maritime crime range up to $50 to $60 billion a year in terms of its impact on global economies. When it comes to piracy, if we take just half of that, and some people believe even that's a conservative figure, that's where you get a figure in the range of $25 billion. I mean, even in a place like Somalia alone, stats range between $50 to $150 million was garnered last year in ransoms. Even if it's $50 million a year, the low end of the figure,
right.
that is still a heck of a lot of money.
Sure. And these pirates are fairly low-tech pirates, although we're getting to that. As you said, that there are these cartels out there, these official sort of mafia-like crime syndicates. And where are they based? And how much do they actually how many ships do you think the average mafia-like gang takes over in a year?
Well, we can tell you that, you know, just in this year alone, since January, for instance, we've had somewhere in the region of 114, 115 attempted attacks just off the waters of Somalia alone.
Okay.
With 478, 479 hostages taken. Last year, that's just for the first 4.5 months of this year, 5.5 months of this year. Those figures are already half of all the figures from last year. Right now, you know, there are being held in pirate hands between 70 and 110 mariners. still being held hostage right now, some of whom have been held since last August.
Oh, God.
And, you know, they're the forgotten ones. They're the ones who aren't going to have a Navy SEAL team or a French commando team come in to rescue them, because they often come from third world countries, developing nations.
Right.
You know, so they are the most vulnerable victims in all of this, because the majority of professional mariners today tend to come from developing countries and third world nations.
But wait, now you mentioned Somalia. What about China? What about the Pacific Ocean?
The Pacific Ocean, things are much more stabler. Well, primarily we're talking in the South China Sea and in Southeast Asia, Strait of Malacca, which was famous for years as a place of piracy. It still definitely goes on there. The second worst place, though, after Somalia, is off of West Africa, off of Nigeria. And I often categorize those pirates as being the ones I would really prefer to avoid, because they are very violent. These are the guys who will, kidnap you. They will cut off your ear. They will murder you. The violent use of violence there is much more severe than it is off of Somalia. Surprisingly, Somali pirates treat their captives pretty well, because they know that a hostage who's injured or dead, you can't bargain with them.
Okay. And so these Nigerian pirates, these are frequently the groups that are on. Are they the ones that are hopped up on cot?
No, cot is what you would see in Somalia. The ones in
okay.
Who come out of the Nigerian Delta region, for instance, they tend to be hopped up on a bizarre belief in themselves and that they can't be killed by bullets.
What? It's like a kind of a what we would think of as sort of a voodoo belief, or
yeah, some of them will actually wear like a bullet around their neck on a necklace that they believe empowers them and gives them supernatural powers against any attacker. It's a historical belief and empower and trying to convince your team, your soldiers, when they're going to go out there and attack something, that they're stronger than the enemy. They're invulnerable, of course. Generally speaking, when someone fires at them, it doesn't stop.
Right. I knew I had a cab driver once who was from India, and I could, he had a large beard, which he had that kind of hairnet for the beard.
Oh, right.
Right. And then he had a turban on, and I made some comment about the hairnet for the beard, and I said, wow, yeah, that must have been growing for a long time. After he was like in his 40s or 50s. And he said, I've never cut any of the hair on my body ever. And he said, I have all of the hair I've ever had, and it's wrapped up in my turban and it swirls around my head. And he said, do you know that an Indian soldier cannot be shot in the head, that a turban of hair will stop any bullet? And it's almost like magic, he said, and that no Indian soldier has ever died from being shot in the head because of their turban. And I didn't know whether to believe him or not. I had nothing to the contrary. It didn't seem likely somehow, but he said it very convincingly. And then he was very confused when, after he said he'd never cut any of the hair on his body, I said, but you cut your nails. And he said, well, yeah. And I said, well, that's hair. And then I got out of the cab. So I think I may have left him with like a crisis of faith before I jumped over to my meeting. But I thought that is an interesting thing. So lots of people, kind of have these beliefs about having some sort of talisman, some sort of, amulet that protects them and gives them supernatural powers. But it's that cot thing. And the Somali pirates, then they chew this low level drug all day long.
Yeah, it's a strange little buzz that you get, and I haven't tried it, but it's I've been with people who have, and as they've described it, it's kind of like having a Coca-Cola, but without the same sort of edginess. Now, when they go off of it, on the other hand, they certainly seem to be edgy to me. Mm. There are a few kind of. There aren't very many other ways of enjoying oneself in a place like Somalia.
Right.
You take what little you can get.
Yeah, cot helps.
Cot helps. And this is actually, there's a thing here about that relates to piracy, because there's nothing else to do. You're destitute. You're poor. Some guy says, listen, hey, come on aboard and join our gang, and you got a chance to make hundreds of thousands of dollars. And if you're living in a country where you're lucky to make $600 a year, that's awful appealing.
Now, how about the low-level pirates, I thought, never actually made that much.
Not most of them don't, but it's like a Ponzi scheme of sorts. Okay, there are those who do, and if you are successful, and if you're one of the half a dozen guys who climbs aboard in a ship that is held for ransom, you can get hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And you never have to work again in Somalia.
Well, you don't, and in fact, one of the things we're seeing recently is this process of taking the money out of Somalia. We're seeing in Kenya, for instance, that there is money laundering going on where money is being wired out of the country because guys don't want to keep it in Somalia for
right.
obvious reasons, and even cases of guys who had, they managed to make a little bit of money, and they're the smart ones are taking the money and running. They're going to places like Nairobi. They're trying to get themselves to Western Europe. They're even trying to get back to North America, where there are expatriate communities here.
And that's because they figure, I'm going to take the money. I'll never have to work again, and I can live a legitimate life. So, what are there pirates then that are as well known in the piracy or in maritime circles? Are there pirates as well known today as, say, the Captain Kidds or the Blackbeards or the pirates of yore?
No, and not yet, at any rate. And the reason for that is that we haven't had enough of a fascination with them until really, really recently. When you go back to the era of the Captain Kidds and the Blackbeards,
right.
and the Captain Morgans, that went on for several decades. And it became a really popular form of entertainment eventually for people who were fascinated by that. This is somewhat of a recent phenomenon, and as a result, if you say the names Abshir Abdullah or General Gray, people don't know who these people
right.
are.
Right, but they're kind of the Captain Morgans of today?
Absolutely, absolutely. The most famous. It's funny that the most famous one that most people have is Abdulwali Muse, the Somali kid who's incarcerated in New York right now, facing trial for the Maersk Alabama incident. He's probably the most famous pirate in the world right now, and he didn't even prove to be particularly successful. So,
no.
he's not unlike Captain Kidd.
Right, who was not particularly successful, but who became very famous just before they hanged him.
That's correct. And
yeah.
also lived for quite a while in Manhattan with a home on Wall Street.
Right. Well, that's true, that Captain Kidd was originally, when he first came to the U.S., he was part of the aristocracy.
Yeah. His story is really kind of, it's interesting because he came from, Scottish stock, and he emigrated to the States to make his living and his livelihood in the colony. He married well, played with the high set in Manhattan, but he grew bored with all of that. Somehow it was just kind of dull, and he wanted to go privateering. He was looking for a little bit of excitement, and when he set out at it, he proved particularly ill-suited to it. His crew mutinied at one point, and his career was very short. He ended up back in Boston and was captured and sent back to England to face trial, and eventually was executed for it. Although, even at the time he was executed, by all accounts, the guy was blind drunk, and it took two tries to hang him before he
right.
finally died.
Pathetic death, actually. Maybe you when you talk about your Captain Morgans and your Captain Kidds, and maybe part of the problem is these pirates today, they don't dress very well.
they dress poorly.
They look terrible. They're not.
Yeah.
There's nothing about it that says I want to be like them. I mean, they look like they just got rousted out of bed in they look like they got yanked out of jail. They're wearing, dirty running shorts and some crappy. T-shirt with some dumb radio station in the United States. It just didn't have any flair to it.
No, they didn't. Now, I would say that probably if we looked at the real pirates hundreds of years ago, they were probably smelly and ill-dressed as well. But it is funny you mentioned that, T-shirts with, K-Rock on it or something
right,
like that.
Right, Froggy 101 or something.
the impact of American culture, it pops up in the strangest places in the world. You know, I have been wandering through fishing communities in Malaysia, and you know, some guy's got a Los Angeles Kings ball cap on.
Right.
And I figured the guy's never seen a hockey game. Or the fishermen will sit around and they'll be watching, you know, professional wrestling on a satellite dish.
Right.
And
Yeah, but see, that's kind of the fun part when you go down to other, like, third world countries where, or emerging world countries, as I guess we should call it, where they have a, they get the remnants, they get the cutouts from American clothing or sports enterprises. For example, somebody brought me a picture once back of some native tribes people in Central America that they had bumped into, and they were all wearing T-shirts that said Minnesota Vikings Super Bowl champions. And so they had printed up all those T-shirts, which, because the Vikings never won a Super Bowl, in the last Super Bowl they were all ready to go, and then they lost. So they got to dump them somewhere. So they give them to a charity and say, keep them out of the U.S. So there are all these people who are walking around thinking the Vikings have won a Super Bowl in Central America, not understanding both how that didn't happen and even probably who the Vikings are. But
you know, Ian, the thing about that, too, is that is the attraction of America. And that's the attraction of the West, is that you go to these places, And the American dream has seeped down to those levels where they're desperate for elements of it. I mean, that's why guys go out and rob ships and that, because they want to be wealthy.
Right. And steal cell phones and steal Western technology. You tell the story at the beginning of the book of this victim of a piracy attack, and he was held captive for like 100 days or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember the guy you went to go visit.
Hassan Abdallah.
Yeah. Oh, that was tough. And he also, all of his stuff was taken, everything he owned, plus his livelihood and even away kind of his soul a little bit.
Yeah, that when I met this gentleman in a slum north of Mombasa on the coast of Kenya, I had no idea really what I was getting into. All I'd been told is, well, he had been involved in a pirate incident. And to see this man who'd been a bosun, and a bosun is like the manager of a deck crew on a ship, and he was a very large man who somewhat imposing, or had been, and instead he was gaunt and he was beaten down, and he, you're right, you described it beautifully. Everything had been taken from him, and this is the toll that it takes. It's not just, you know,
right,
losing your cell phone or something like that. He hadn't been able to work. He hadn't been able to support his family. Everything had been taken from him, his livelihood, his soul,
right,
if you will.
Yeah. So, all right, but I can't, I mean, I know that there are worse stories. I mean, as sad as that is, there are worse stories than that. What are the most terrible things you're hearing about out there as people talk about what pirates are doing and how they're terrorizing the high seas?
Well, I think one of the things that's we've been hearing a few unconfirmed reports lately is that there may be a degree of desperation among some pirates holding their captives that is causing either mental torture, or we don't know if there's physical torture going on. But the thing that is the hardest is holding somebody hostage for months and months. And it's imprisoning them and without knowing when you're going to be released. It's a
right.
It's a sentence,
sure,
with no end.
Right, right, right. Well, I want to talk about some of the things that happen, typically what happens when these ships are taken, what the terror is on the seas. And then I want to ask you about remedies based on your experience interviewing the pirates, and we'll talk more about that, but also the victims and looking at this. What are some other ways that we can stop piracy on the seas? Terror on the Seas is the name of the book. Daniel Sekulich is the author. True Tales of Modern Day Pirates, next on Coast to Coast AM. Take a look at my blog, by the way, if you go to the website, coasttocoastam.com. I put a couple of cool links up there and some photos, too, if you haven't taken a look at it. Always a couple of good smiles and some cool stories we didn't get back to on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.